Welcome to a one day sitting. As we're doing plenty of sitting today, it seems appropriate to talk about sitting, meditation, zazen. To explore what this is and the many ways to practice sitting through the day. In our Zen tradition, we often don't have so many practical instructions about sitting. For example, Bodhidharma, our first Chinese Zen ancestor, would just say things like, with a mind like a wall, just enter the way. So, that doesn't give us that much to go on. But as I understand it, when Bodhidharma would say things like that, he was saying them in the context of a whole culture of meditation practices all around him. One meditative tradition in China is called the Tiantai School, named after Mount Tiantai, where its founders lived. Tiantai, Juri, was one of the founders of the Tiantai school and lived about the same time as Bodhidharma. So I think that Tiantai and Zen, or Chinese Chan, influenced each other a lot over the centuries. They were both meditative traditions, exploring how to direct the mind and practice this inward way of being to be free from suffering and realize what the Buddha realized. And even in Japan, the Tiantai school became the Tendai school and continues to this day. And Dogen, our Japanese Zen founder, actually started practicing in the Tendai school. He was ordained as a Tendai priest before he discovered Zen. So through the centuries, these two schools of Tendai and Zen, Tiantai and Chan, had some relationship and influenced each other. And one difference we could point out about these two schools of Buddha Dharma is that Tiantai did give more practical instructions instead of being based on Zen stories and very direct, pithy, pointing out instructions. Tiantai teachings offered kind of more step-by-step practices. And I think this is good for us in America during a one-day sitting. So there's this particular relatively short teaching by Juri, one of the Tiantai founders in the 6th century China, around the same time as Bodhidharma, called the 6 Subtle Dharma Gates, or we could translate as the 6 Dharma Gates to the Subtle, or to the Sublime. I think maybe more accurate to say like that, because when Juri defines each of these words in the title, he says, what does this subtle or sublime mean? And he said, this is the cessation of suffering that is nirvana. So it's not so much that the Dharma gates are subtle. I think the Dharma gates are subtle, actually. But I think the meaning of the title is six Dharma gates to realize the sublime, subtle nirvana. But it's been translated both ways. Here's one called the Six Dharma Gates to the Sublime. The subtle, the sublime, the mysterious, the wondrous would all be translations of this character, Myo. And particularly these six Dharma gates, they're gateways, they're entrances to practice. They involve the breath, which Zen, traditional Zen teachings almost never mention the breath, interestingly. So I think this, our practice that we often hear in American Zen of counting and following the breath may be very influenced by this early Tiantai school. And of course the Buddha in India taught following the breath. I don't recall ever seeing in the Indian sutras of the Buddha counting the breath in sets of 10. It may be in some sutra in the early teachings of the Buddha, but I don't recall ever seeing that particular formulation. But it is in this text, counting the breath in sets of 10, which is you might have all heard of. We often offer that as a Zazen instruction. So it occurs to me when looking at this that maybe this counting the breath in sets of 10 came from this text. Could be. Because it's taught, this is the 6th century, it's quite a while ago, and this was taught, and I don't know of any earlier texts that teach that particular. Technique. So the six gates are a kind of progression, and you maybe all know of shamatha and vipassana. Shamatha being a calming, settling the mind into stillness, where we have a stable foundation to look around and see what's happening. And the vipassana is like looking around and seeing what's happening. Insight, investigation, analysis, we might even say. Shamatha and vipassana. So the first three of these gates of juri are shamatha practices, and the second three are vipassana practices. One of them is actually called shamatha, and one's called vipassana, two of the six. So the first one is first of these six gates in this kind of progression. I think we could see these in a kind of step-by-step progression towards more and more subtlety of meditation. First is called counting the breath. Juri himself says, as for cultivation of counting, the practitioner regulates and harmonizes the breath, so that it's neither too rough nor too subtle. And actually, in the Chinese it says, regulates and harmonizes the qi and breath. Qi, you know, is closely related to breath, as in qigong and tai chi and practices. It's the internal energy, the subtle energy body is the qi body. India, prana, closely related to breath. So we can harmonize the qi by harmonizing the breath. I think these teachings about qi were much earlier than Juri's time in China. Goes way, way back. Taoist practice. One proceeds in an unhurried fashion, slowly counting, going from 1 up to 10. One focuses the mind on counting and does not allow it to run off and become scattered. This is what's meant by counting. And he always he sets this up as there's a cultivation and a realization. Actually, a practice and a realization. These same terms that Dogen uses, shu and sho, interestingly, are here much in this much earlier text. So that's the cultivation, the practice, and the realization of this counting is without having to put forth any particular effort, the mind abides in the object of the breath. In other words, one intentionally cultivates the practice of counting, and then realizing counting is when the mind is actually staying with the breath, staying with the numbers. I think this counting is quite wonderful. I was trying to practice it a little bit these past periods. The nice thing about counting the breath is it gives very direct feedback of how present one is. Right? Because if you go off the number, you lose track immediately. If you're not counting, you may be like, your mind may be wandering off, but you don't get that much feedback so directly, because you might kind of feel as if you're staying with the breath, but you might have missed a few in between. You don't really notice. But when counting, that's what I notice, is if you lose the number, you lose the number. You know right away that you've lost it. So it can be quite humbling to count the breath and see that you maybe can't get to 10. Whereas if you're not counting, it's maybe not that humbling, because you're like, well, I think I've been staying with the breath pretty much. I don't really notice. And sets of 10 seems nice, because it's not like you're just counting up to 1,000 or something endlessly. It's simple enough, it's short enough sequence. You just get to 10, and then you come back to 1. And generally the practice is, if you miss, if you're like, you forget what number you're on, you just stop and go back to 1 again. That's the first subtle Dharma gate, counting the breath in sets of 10. A lot could be said about this, of course, but we don't have that much time, so this is an overview. Next Dharma gate is called following the breath. You might ask, what's the difference? Following the breath is now just attending to the breath, but without counting it. Juri says, as for the cultivation of following, one lets go of or relinquishes the previous dharma of counting. One then relies single-mindedly on following the coming and going of the breath. Focusing the mind, taking the breath as object, again. The mind remains free of any distraction or scattering of one's point of attention. This is following the breath. He also says, around the realization of this following, it's like counting becomes a little bit too coarse. So it's almost like a natural transition. I understand there may be various ways to interpret this, but I would understand this sequential thing is like you're counting the breath in sets of 10, and you actually are staying with it. And one might say that I'm not going to go on to the next Dharma gate until I'm really settled in the present Dharma gate. So we might spend a whole day just counting in sets of 10 and not quite getting to 10. And I think that's good. I think we can work on that endlessly. Some people maybe do practice counting their breath in sets of 10 for years with no other practice. So any one particular gate here is perfect and complete. But if we're counting in sets of 10 and we're actually staying with it, And in the past, I've sometimes, when trying to kind of cultivate this in sort of step by step in a sesshin kind of setting, a retreat, I'll kind of set up for myself, well, decide some point when it seems like the mind is steady enough counting to move on to following. Like one might say, even if I'll count the breath in sets of 10, 3 sets of 10, and then I know I'm like, you know, pretty, you might say that's not that much, that's just a few minutes actually. But if we can stay with it like that, one could decide at that point to like, oh, I've noticed I'm not getting distracted from the breath for 3 sets of 10, for 30 breaths. That's enough to move on to following. In other words, to let go of the counting and just follow the breath without the coarseness of counting. I think at some point, if we're really focused and concentrated, counting the breath starts feeling a little bit clunky, or it can feel a little bit coarse, like extra, a little extra. We don't need the counting, because we're already staying with the breath very steadily. And then it's more, maybe more ease or relaxation to stop that extra step, that extra effort of, it's a little bit conceptual too, like the numbers. They're not very conceptual. That's why counting is kind of a nice thing to cut through conceptual thought, but it's a little conceptual. Just following the breath is just staying with the sensation, a physical sensation. And so there's some ease there compared to all these numbers. And the third Dharma gate, counting, following, stopping. The third is called stopping, which is the Chinese way of translating shamatha. The term, Sanskrit term shamatha, the Chinese translation is the character that means stop. So shamatha, you know, actually means maybe more literally something like calm abiding. It has to do with like settled, peaceful, relaxed, calm. And abiding is like stillness, non-moving. So maybe the abiding part is what the Chinese picked up on to say stop. Stop doesn't necessarily have this calm feeling, but maybe that's that Chinese way of being very concise and simple. Let's just call it stop. Maybe we could say what stops is that the discursive churning mind just comes to rest in the present. It stops. And again, Juri says, one becomes aware of following the breath as a coarse activity. The mind is a little bit averse to this. Even following the breath now is a little bit extra. One wishes to let it go. This is a funny analogy, but he says, this is analogous to when a person has become exhausted and desires to sleep, thus causing him to be disinclined to deal with his many tasks. So stopping is not really like going to sleep. So it's a little funny metaphor. But it has that feeling of like this work of counting and maybe now just following. It's a little bit of effort and work. And one desires to actually just rest and not have so many tasks. It's not such a big task to follow the breath, but it's a little bit like a task. One desires to just rest without any particular task in the present moment is like, then one should relinquish the following the breath and cultivate stopping or just resting in the present. I think it's a beautiful way of talking about this transition. And you could say there's some intention there. It's not like the mind is like, let's see. It's a kind of subtle, refined mind already. So it's not like, okay, on three, we're gonna go from following to stopping and stop now. There might be a little conversation like that in the mind, but I think it might just be the little thought of like, I'm really feel quite present and staying with the breath, and it feels a little extra, little extra effort here that I don't need. Sometimes we really do need that effort when the mind's wandering all over the place. That's why counting and following are so great, and the proposed practices. But if the mind's really settled, they might feel extra. And there might be a moment where I think it's actually good to notice the transition between each of these gates. Like, you get to the one, from counting, you're at the end of one set of 10, and the mind is kind of like, I'm ready to let go of counting. So maybe not just arbitrarily, but right at the end of a set of 10, 10. And the next breath comes, and there's no number. You know, that little transition. And you can catch that feeling of maybe that lightness. Oh, there's no number now. And this next transition would be like you're following breath, breath. Now ready for the transition. Just let go of the attending to the breath. And there's just present moment awareness. Sometimes we call it this unsupported shamatha. It's calm abiding. All three of these practices are the shamatha, calm abiding practices. But first you have the support of the breath. This one has no particular support except the present moment. It's wider. It's a wider object. I still propose it's an object of meditation. But the object is now called the whole field of experience in the present moment. Sounds of the cars going by are happening. If we're really focusing on counting and following the breath, we maybe don't notice the sounds of the cars. I think ideally, maybe they're in slight background, but we're coming right back to the object of the breath. Now this is widening the object to actually be totally open all the senses. We hear the sound of the car and the wind chime and the other body sensations. The breath is a body sensation, but now, oh, I didn't even notice before, but my knees really hurt. I was so focused on the breath, I didn't even notice. Or now open, it's wider openness. Present moment. Object. So, because it's a particular object, this doesn't mean that we're just kind of spacing out and the mind is wandering off to the dusty realms of other lands. The marker, the criterion, the point to see if it's stopping is it present? Is the mind really just in this moment? The sounds and sensations, the senses are all the present moment experience. We're not thinking about the past and future. But this is where it's very easy to lose it. As you know, if you tried this without the support of counting or following the breath, the mind tends to slip away. It's very tricky. It doesn't, we don't notice it. And without that very specific object of the breath, where we notice more easily that we're off, the mind wanders off. So that's why I think this sequence is really nice. Counting the breath, that we're really honest with ourselves, we're really counting in sets of 10 and we're staying with it. And if we're finding trouble doing that, it's really a matter of just giving ourselves to it. Just, this is all I have to do today, is just attend to this breath and this present. Many things I have to do in my life, but like, we'll deal with them later, at the end of the day. Of course, this is hard to do, but it's like setting that intention, give myself to this practice all day. And what a gift to ourselves to do. counting, following, stopping, settling the mind in the present. It is this present moment, but it's very wide, multi-sensory experience. So that's the first three, and I think these three are these three shamatha practices are good to work on all day. And I maybe shouldn't even bother mentioning the other three, but because it's a list of six, here's, you should know, here they are. I would say if it starts sounding too fancy or extra, then I think it is fine to spend a whole day, because how often do we spend a day practicing settling the mind in the present moment? And it's like, you know, if we can easily do that, then we can move on to these other ones. And of course, there's no rules about this. You can experiment with all of this. This is, I often see, especially like, you know, Zazen in general, but like a one-day sitting or a sesshin, I often see as like a laboratory, like experimental lab of the mind. It's like this chance to really explore the mind in all these different ways. And it's so set up for that. We have nothing to do. It's silently look inward. So, those three are shamatha. The third, called stopping, is actually called shamatha, the Chinese term, stopping. The fourth well, let me just read the jury's description of the cultivation of this stopping without the particular objects of the breath. He says, one puts to rest all thought taking anything as an object. Maybe we could say that thought taking, there's a subtle thought that takes the breath as an object. In this unsupported kind of shamatha, one puts to rest all thought taking anything as an object. One does not engage in either counting or following the breath. One fixes or stabilizes the mind and makes it still. This is called the cultivation of shamatha, or stopping, stabilization. Realizing this, one becomes aware of body and mind seeming to vanish entirely as one then enters into samadhi. That's a description of the realization of it. Body and mind seeming to vanish entirely. Now, our Zen founder Dogen talks about Zazen as the dropping off of body and mind. This may or may not be the same thing, but sounds quite similar. Dropping off body and mind. This is the realization of shamatha, in this case, is one becomes aware of body and mind seeming to vanish entirely as one enters into samadhi. And samadhi is the term that means one-pointedness of mind and object. So it's kind of like, if the object is the present moment, and the mind being aware of the present moment, one just becomes the present moment. There's no longer me aware of the present moment. And I think we sometimes taste a little of this. We're just resting in the present. There's no sense of me here. And body and mind as separate entities seem to vanish or drop away. One remains continuously unmoving. At this time, settled into the shamatha, the practitioner reflects thus. So this this kind of thought can arise in the stillness of the present. Although this samadhi is unconditioned, non-doing, quiescent, secure, blissful, nonetheless, it is devoid of any skillful means associated with wisdom. Thus, it remains unable to bring about the destruction of the cycle of birth and death, samsara. Unquote. So it might not be that like one actually thinks that sentence exactly, but that's the old style way of putting it. It might just be that we're really resting in the present moment, and then some subtle thought arises in the present that doesn't pull us far away, but it's just like, maybe this isn't the complete realization of Buddha's enlightenment. It's very calm, very, very pleasant, maybe blissful, easeful, present moment. But the Buddha himself, you know, had that thought. He learned these very refined concentration states, and the most exalted refinements of meditative concentration in India in his time, supposedly, and he still felt like, I don't think this is quite the whole thing yet. His teacher's like, this is the whole thing, and he's like, I'm not sure about that. And there's no one else to teach. You guys are the best teachers, and there's nothing else to that you can teach me now, so I have to go off and explore more deeply on my own. This was the Buddha's story. We need to have some insight into reality here, besides just the settled sitting. So some thought like this, some curiosity might arise. One has this thought, this absorption in the present belongs entirely to the sphere of causes and conditions. It depends on the five skandhas and the aspects of mind. Therefore, it's a little bit false and not reflective of reality. It's dependent on particular conditions, like being really still and that no one's bothering us and things like this. If the conditions change and somebody says, excuse me, can you come over here and do this? Then we say, we lose the stillness completely. It's dependent. Whereas Buddha's enlightenment doesn't depend on any particular conditions. It's unshakable, no matter what anyone says or does. So that would be another little doubt we might have. It's quite stable here, but it's not completely dependable. It's dependent on the conditions, including the five skandhas, body and mind. So the cultivation of this next, the fourth Dharma gate, is called Vipassana, or contemplation. Or the Chinese character for Vipassana is the character that means seeing. So in Chinese, Shamatha and Vipassana are stopping and seeing. They try to just choose these very, very simple pointers towards these practices. I think that's pretty good. Vipassana does mean something like insight or seeing what is directly. It can mean seeing and also can mean contemplate, the Chinese character. Guanyin Bodhisattva is Avalokiteshvara. Guanyin means contemplating, regarding, or seeing sounds of the world. Guan Shiryin is contemplating world sounds, and we sometimes often abbreviate it. Guanyin or Kanon in Japanese is literally like regarder of sound. Sounds. We say the cries of the world. Literally, Guanyin is regarder or seer of sounds. open to the whole world, the cries of the world. So this guan is the Chinese character for vipassana. And jur is the Chinese for stopping. Or in Chinese, like kan, and stopping is shi. So this little footnote may be kind of interesting, that there's often a compound, shamatha dash vipassana. In Japanese is shikan. And we have this term shikantaza, that is different characters. Shikan in that case means only or just as a compound. But there's a theory that there may be some play on this, that shikantaza means just sitting. If you take it like as the sound of it, it actually could mean that, you know, as a sort of word play, sound play. It's the same sound as very common phrase shikan, meaning shamatha vipassana. So shikantaza means just sitting, but maybe there's a little play in there. It's like shamatha vipassana, sitting. You know, it doesn't literally mean shamatha vipassana, right? It's just the same sound, exact same sound. So, so contemplation, vipassana here, is in the midst of the mind immersed in absorption. So you don't leave the stillness of the present moment. If you start thinking, heavy-duty thinking, you lose that grounding in the stillness of shamatha. So in the midst of the mind immersed in the absorption of stillness and presence, one employs wisdom to make distinctions. So if we're not really settled and grounded like that and we start making distinctions, we just get into dualistic conceptual discursiveness. But there's a subtle way of making distinctions, employing wisdom to make distinctions from the ground or space of present moment stillness. One contemplates the fine and subtle features of the breath as it goes forth and comes in. So it's still connected to the breath here in a way. You can start analyzing or looking at the breath. It's like a wind in the midst of space. So one can start contemplating the breath now as a wind in the midst of vast space. The skin, flesh, bones, and 36 things making up the body, so this is like body contemplation, are all devoid of substantiality, like the coreless plantain tree, which is one of those old Indian metaphors for emptiness. Like a banana tree is the same. I just saw some in Texas banana trees, and they told me about, you cut them down, they're like totally light, they're like styrofoam. Because there's no solid core in the middle. They look big, solid tree. And I don't think it's actually like a round, open hole. I think it's just more like very like lightweight foam sort of interior. Does anyone know about plantain or banana trees, actually? I don't think it's like you could stand inside there like an empty space. But it looks very solid and substantial and heavy, but it's like a movie set where they have big logs, but they're actually styrofoam and they can throw them around, like Lord of the Rings. It's fake. The body is actually, all these solid things in the body are as devoid of substantiality and solidity as the core of a plantain tree. Even consciousness and one's mind is impermanent. It doesn't abide even for kshana. Kshana is like the Sanskrit term for like a 64th of a second or something like that. A moment The mind doesn't abide even for a moment. Neither oneself nor anyone else truly exists. The dharmas of body, feeling, and mind are all devoid of inherently existent nature. One is unable to ultimately apprehend the existence of any person or anything. On what then could meditative absorption possibly depend? This is the cultivation of contemplation. So all the things that we think it depends on and everything in our present moment experience, we start analyzing that it's not really as solid and real as it seems. Or particularly the body and mind that the stillness depends on. I think that's the best thing to start exploring, because it's not so abstract. If we start saying, well, let's think about my car out there, I think it's not as direct. It's you can do that maybe outside of meditation, but if we're really in shamatha, in the stillness of the present, I think it's good to use the present experience. I have this feeling in the body right now, and the sense of a body and mind. This in the present experience, we analyze the content of the present experience without getting too abstract, I think is really helpful. As for the realization of contemplation, when one's contemplating in this manner, one gains realization of the four foundations of mindfulness and destroys the four inverted views. So one becomes mindful and starts realizing what these four foundations are, the body, the feelings, the mind, and objects of mind. And destroys the four inverted views are that conditioned things are permanent. We start seeing that conditioned things actually don't last for more than a kshana, a moment, that there's no independent self, that conditioned things are not in accord with the pure suchness of reality, and and that they're not ultimately satisfying. Conditioned things are, because they're impermanent, they're not so reliable. So we realize that. So, okay. That's number four. So it's contemplation. And we have counting the breath, following the breath, stopping. You could even apply them all to the breath in some ways. You could say stopping the breath as a particular object. Contemplating the breath, he talked about, but, you know, also contemplating everything. Now, five is called returning. Returning. As for the cultivation of turning, once one has realized that contemplation itself, that vipassana actually arises from the mind, one should turn back the direction of one's contemplation so that one now contemplates that very mind that's engaged in contemplation. And this is very much like a lot of Zen teachings, like turning the light of awareness around and shining it back. It's a common Zen expression. I think the same instruction here. We're now contemplating, but it's a little bit deeper now. We're saying, there's this mind that's contemplating, but who is actually doing the contemplation? So it's turning back the awareness to contemplate the mind that's contemplating. And what is that mind that's contemplating? We can't get a hold of it. Mind is ungraspable. As for this mind which engages in contemplation, from what does it arise? Is it generated by contemplative thought, or is it generated by something other than contemplative thought? In other words, where does this mind come from? We can't actually say. Turning the light back to the source of awareness. Also, we've been talking about this year, right? This mirror awareness, I think, is another way of talking about this practice of turning awareness back to the source. It's like we're paying attention to all the reflections in the mirror, and we like look back directly at the mirror itself. So you could say the reflections in the mirror are like the Vipassana contemplations of like the thought, like, this body maybe isn't as solid as it seems. It's still a reflection in the mirror. And like, what's the mirror that's reflecting that thought? Turning awareness back to the source. As for the realization of turning, the wisdom of the mind opens forth and develops in a way no longer requiring one to bring to bear additional skillful effort. It carries on in a way allowing one to naturally be able to invoke analyses, turn back toward the origin, and return to the source. So there's still kind of, it sounds like it's implying there's still a kind of subtle analysis, but not exactly like it's not so conceptual now. It's more the analysis that's actually turning back to the source. Turning towards the origin and returning to the source of awareness. And then the last sixth Dharma gate is called purity, or purifying. If we want to make them all into verbs, we could say counting, following, stopping, seeing, returning, purifying the breath, even. And it's just basically the end. As for the cultivation of purification, through realizing the purity of the form aggregate and all five skandhas, one refrains from generating false thoughts about it and does not course in discriminations regarding it. The same is true with feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. One has no more false thoughts, is a Chinese way of saying literally false thinking is one way of translating these words, like parikalpita in Sanskrit, which means like imaginative projection onto things. So one no longer has imaginative projection of form, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. One puts to rest all these imputations and imaginations. This constitutes the cultivation of purification. As for the realization of purification, when one is cultivating in this manner, one experiences a sudden penetration through to the circumstance where the mind accords with wisdom completely. Unimpeded skillful means continuously manifest, and abiding in the direct experiencing of samadhi, the mind remains free of any dependence on anything at all. It's kind of like the end. There's still the appearance, of course, of dependence on the body and mind and the room and the cushion and our fellow practitioners and all of this, but there's this, when it's all illusory, there's no dependence on any actual things at all. There's just coursing in freedom and purification. I think in Zen and Buddhism in general, purification means purification of all our deluded ideas, particularly about duality of subject and object. Purity means non-dual reality. So, we might not get through all these Dharma gates today, but they're all on, there's a course. It's possible to practice. And I think particularly the first three are really excellent to become more and more grounded in. And if we find ourselves really grounded, we might start exploring, you know, in whatever creative way we find ourselves, like, what is this? What's happening here anyway? What is this person, this body and mind, this sitting, this practice? I can't actually pinpoint it. I can't quite get a hold of any of it. And if we get too discursive about these things, too conceptual, I think we start to notice the presence starts to disperse, and now we're just like churning our mental gear wheels. I think we have some feeling about that, so then we can like kind of shift back a little bit towards just the sound of the bird, the body on the cushion, total present experience, nowhere other than here. And then we're settled there again. What is that sound of the bird? Is it actually out there? Or is it in here? Or is it nowhere in between? So, Jiri's six Dharma gates to the sublime. We don't hear about so much in Zen. And there you have it. Do you have any maybe brief questions or comments about that? Or particularly, you know, how to practice today, this precious, rare opportunity we have? Yes. Yeah, the breath is like a wind in space,
yeah,
vast
so,
space.
I find that's kind of the only way I can sort of get any handle on emptiness, is that, and then the other is just breath and this me, supposedly, but it's really in space, and most of me is space, you know, I mean, just even down to the atomic level.
Now, one kind of experiential way of talking about emptiness is sometimes space, spaciousness of mind, and kind of bringing spaciousness into our experience of breath and body and stuff. I think if we try to analyze it I say it's an experiential way of talking about emptiness. I think technically, looking at the meaning of emptiness in the more philosophical sense, I think it doesn't quite hold up there. Because it's, I think, sometimes people try to do that, you know, with quantum physics and so on, of like, well, the fact that our body is mostly space, and we know this scientifically, is that the same as Buddhist emptiness? And I would say, technically, no, not really, you know, strictly speaking, but they're related. And I think experientially, bringing the sense of spaciousness into body, breath, and experience opens us to emptiness. Emptiness is, I think, to put it really simply in the Buddhist sense, is like that everything is free of all our ideas of it, free of all our kind of conceptions and fixed notions of it. in a very, very simple way of putting. And that is kind of spacious experientially. There's a kind of tight solidity when we're like grasping things with our conceptual mind. Things are free of what we think they are. We think this is solid and fixed and external to mind, for example. And emptiness means it's free of those very basic thoughts. So thoughts. If we're obsessing about something in zazen, of course, a nice practice is. It's a little bit like approaching from the emptiness side of looking and seeing, looking, actually analyzing a little bit to say, oh, this, I'm really caught up in this thought. I'm getting really disturbed by this mental thought, and like to ask, is what I'm thinking about really, do I know that's really true and real? That's kind of like a really simple sort of analysis towards the emptiness of it. Well, maybe it's like what I'm thinking has nothing to do with what's really happening at all. And that actually can help us. There's an emptiness kind of teaching that can help bring us back to shamatha and settling in the present. So that's a way in which these gates can all roll around. Don't necessarily have to follow this particular order. A little bit of analysis at the beginning when we're trying to just settle into the present, but we're totally obsessed about some event that happened to us yesterday or whatever. Look at it, you know, do a little contemplation, and that releases it, and we're then more settled, and then even deeper contemplation can arise from the settledness. Please enjoy the day of sitting. We could have tea with more discussion in the afternoon. May our attention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.